So this seminar will be given by Meng Chen. He will talk about fractons. Api Daw will handle Q&A.
Okay, can everyone hear me? Okay, so I'll be talking about fractonic U1 gauge series. So sorry that I left a very general title, fractons, in the schedule. And thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity to talk about our work. Okay, so in the lectures of the past few days, so we have seen many examples of quantum phases with fractionalized excitations. And I'll also talk about these kind of states in this talk. In particular, I'll focus on states which have well-defined quadriparticles. So the low energy states consist of well-defined quadriparticles, but the system could be gapped or gapless. So these quadriparticle states are fractionalized, meaning that they are well-defined, localized quadriparticles, but they cannot be created locally. They have to be created by some non-local means. So the most familiar example are topological order states like the toric codes or double semion topological order in two dimensions, where we can create anions using a string operator. You know, by applying an open string operator, we create a pair of anions at the ends. And this string itself does not create any excitation, and it's really invisible. However, this is not the only way that anion quadriparticles can be created. In some other models, like the X-cube model that Xie talked about yesterday, the quadriparticles have to be created using a membrane operator, like a rectangular membrane operator, and they appear at the corners of this membrane operator. And that's pretty much the only way that you can create these quadriparticles. And even more weird ways of creating quadriparticles occur in some other examples, some other lattice models. For example, you can have models where quadriparticles must be created on the corners of a fractal-shaped operator. And for example, this happens in a spin model called the Haar's cubic code. So there are these various different ways of creating quadriparticles in a quantum phase. And what I'll be talking about are the fractonic phases. And these and the definition here is very phenomenological. So all I mean by fractonic phase is just that quadriparticles in this phase have restricted mobility. They can be completely immobile, or they can move in certain directions, or then whatever kind of mobility, as long as it's reduced from the full mobility of that dimensionality, we call it the fractonic phase, where such quadriparticles arise. And of course, all of these happen without any disorder. So this restricted mobility occurred due to some other reason than the more familiar kinds of reasons for localization. And one of the kind of the main message, one of the main thing that I think we learned from the discovery of fractonic phases is that this phenomenon of restricted mobility is really a topological phenomenon that worth investigation. Okay, so I have just one slide talking about kind of general landscape of fracton phases as we know of today. I only have 40 minutes. There's no way that I can cover all these different aspects of fracton phases, and I'll just be talking about one particular type of fracton phases, the one that arises in gapless U1, generalized U1 gauge series. But as we know, by now, there are these, roughly speaking, there are these three kinds of fracton phases. Of course, this classification might well be very artificial, but the first kind that I'll be talking about today is a U1 gauge theory of U1 tensor gauge theory. And related to these fracton phases, there are also new kinds of symmetries that in some sense are responsible for the emergence of these fractonic particles. And we can also think about fractal faces with these exotic symmetries. And that's also a huge topic right now. So corresponding to U1 tensor gauge theory, we have U1 multiple symmetries. Now I'll have more to say about this later. And we have seen examples of a planar subsystem symmetries from Xie's talk yesterday, and they generally give rise to so-called type 1 fractal models, like the XQ model. And further, there are these symmetries that defined on fractal-shaped submanifolds, what I showed on the previous slide, and these are related to type 2 fractal models. So even though fracton, this word has only been around for about 5 years, I believe, there has been a lot of research going on, luckily there have been two nice reviews written on this subject, one by Nandi Kishore and Hermely back 2 years ago, and more recent one earlier this year by Freckel, Xie Chen, and Yi Zhi Yu. So I probably won't have all the references, and you can look up these reviews for a more complete reference. Okay, and here's a plan of the talk. So basically, I want to just discuss a couple of stories about how we think about these fractonic U1 gauge theories. And the basic kind of theme is that how to build these fractonic U1 gauge theories from the ordinary Maxwell theory that we are all very familiar with. And I'll discuss two ways to sort of obtain a fractonic U1 gauge theory from an ordinary Maxwell theory. One is through gauging. This method of gauging has sort of appeared in both Xie's lecture and also in Michael's lecture on partons, and also use this method to obtain fractonic gauge theories from an ordinary U1 gauge theory. And the next one is a slightly different point of view that I'll just call it defect network for now, and I'll explain later what this means. I don't think I have time to talk about the last item on this slide, but if time permits, I'll briefly discuss a new kind of fractonic phase from planar U1 transignment theories. Okay, so just to get started, let me briefly review the physics of a 3+1 U1 gauge theory, the Maxwell electromagnetism, basically, and arguably the most familiar gauge theories to everybody. And these are U1 gauge theories with gapped electric and magnetic charges. So I include magnetic charges because for condensed matter applications, usually the U1 gauge theories are emergent, and it's natural to consider compact U1 gauge theories, which automatically have magnetic monopole excitations. So roughly speaking, the low energy states of this U1 gauge theory in 3+1 look like the following. So you have gapless photons, you're just propagating photons at low energy, and above some energy gap, one starts to have electric and magnetic charges. So the gap makes sure that these charges are well-defined quadriparticles, they're actually localized, that's the standard picture of a 3+1 U1 gauge theory. And the low energy physics is just the standard Maxwell electromagnetism, Hamiltonian, can be just written as E squared plus B squared, basically. Okay, so let me give a little more details about U1 gauge theory. I'm sure everyone knows about this, and we've seen the similar discussions from Xie's talk and also Michael's talk, but I'll just go through this just to make sure that we are all on the same page. So we have a compact U1 gauge field, A of I, and to define gauge theory, we need to specify how gauge transformations act in this theory. So these are A of I goes to plus the partial of some gauge parameter chi. Okay. So A of I here is a vector. And from the gauge transmission, you can read off the Gauss law, which is just that the charge density is equal to a divergence of electric field. And one important consequence of Gauss law is that if you integrate all charge density over space, you get zero. That follows from the Gauss law, and that means the gauge invariant states must be charge neutral. Okay. And I'll just, again, mention that there are gapped bosonic electric and magnetic charges. Recently it was discovered that there are a whole new class of Yuan gauge theories which look similar at low energy. They just have gapless photons, gapless generalized photons. But above this charge gap, what you have are fractonic charges. These charges have restricted mobility. And I'll use a simple example to discuss, I'll use the simplest example to illustrate these fractonic Yuan gauge theories. And these are symmetric tensor gauge theories with a scalar charge. So there's a slight variational theory with vector charge, but I'll just focus on the case of scalar charge. So in this case, the gauge fields, the U1 gauge fields is a symmetric tensor. So it carries two indices, I and J, and it's symmetric respect to the two indices. And the gauge transformation looks like the following. So you have A of IJ goes to FIJ plus the gauge transformation parameter, but with a two derivative, partial I, partial J. And from here, you can also define electric fields, which are the conjugate variables of this AIJ, and also write down a gauge invariant magnetic field of this gauge field, and build a Hamiltonian, basically E squared plus B squared. And solving this Hamiltonian, one finds that you have photons with linear dispersion, kind of similar to the Maxwell theory, but the Gauss law, because of this different looking gauge transformation, the Gauss law takes a very different form. So basically two derivative sort of propagates to Gauss law, and you have a two derivative acting on the electric field, which also carries two indices, and that equals a scalar charge density. So this unusual form of the Gauss law implies the two conservation laws. So one is a familiar one. I mean, this is still a U1 gauge series, so you have charge neutrality. But because of the two derivatives, now there's a second conservation law, which is that x times the density integrated over the whole space is also conserved. And this is nothing but the dipole moment. So that the conservation of dipole moment immediately implies that the charges are not, a single charge is not movable, because moving a charge in any direction must change the dipole moment of the theory, but now the dipole moment is forced to vanish because of the gauge constraints. Okay. So Hilbert space only contains states with zero dipole moments. So there's no way to move a charge, single charge, without touching the others. So the theory actually was discussed back some 15 years ago by Chen Ke-hsiu, and then but this fractonic aspect of the theory was really brought up by Michael Practical 3 years ago. Okay, in the following, I'll put the theories on lattice just to make everything as explicit as possible. And we have seen how to define a U1 lattice gauge theory. And we simply have rotors on each edge, and these rotors satisfy the canonical commutation relation. You have a phase variable A and integer charge variable E, and they satisfy their commutator is I. And because we have compact U1 gauge field, these E's take integer values and A's are 2 pi periodic. And we can easily put Gauss law and also the B squared term on the lattice. So the Gauss law is, you can just write down the lattice version of the divergence, which I denoted here, for brevity, just by the divergence of E at the site R. basically it's a sum of the E's around this site with proper signs. Okay, and that should equal to the charge at this site. And then we also have a magnetic field term for each face on the cubic lattice. Okay, so let me show the full Hamiltonian. So here I impose a Gauss law energetically. Okay, so the first term is a Gauss law. The first term is a Gauss law, which is imposed energetically. And the second term is a lattice version of the B squared term. And the last term is a lattice version of E squared term. Okay. And we know as a fact that this model is in the gapless Coulomb phase, which means you have propagating photons at low energy for small values of U over K, okay, when U is small. Okay, because the Gauss law is imposed energetically, it's not as a hard constraint on Hilbert space, but rather it's just a term in the Hamiltonian. The theory automatically comes with gap charges. Basically, you can violate these Gauss law terms, and these are integer value charges, and these are just gap charges of the theory. Okay. So you can see that the Gauss law commutes with all the other terms. This particular term commutes with all the other terms in the Hamiltonian. Okay. And that's, of course, expected because it's a Gauss law. But as written, that means that as written, the charges are completely static. Okay. So no terms give any dynamics to this charge. These are conserved quantities of the Hamiltonian. And this is also known as an electric one-form symmetry of this particular Hamiltonian that I wrote on the previous slide, okay. Which also means in the more kind of continuum language, electric flux is conserved for all closed surfaces. That's just Gauss theorem that electric flux is equal to the charge density, charge, the enclosed charge inside the surface. But of course, this is artificial. Right? This is because we have chosen this particular form of the Hamiltonian, and we are allowed to add more terms. For example, we can add these gauge symmetry breaking terms, but now they are just allowed because these A's and E's are physical degrees of freedom, the rotor fields. For example, we can just add E to the I of A term, or maybe cosine of A, that creates a pair of charges plus one and minus one on the two neighboring sides because A does not commute with Gauss law. And that induces the motion of charge and gives them the dispersions, et cetera. So charges become dynamical once these more generic terms are added to the Hamiltonian. Okay. Okay, so once we have these symmetries, we can ask what happens if we promote these symmetries to a local symmetry. You can actually promote the full electric one-form symmetry to a local symmetry, but I'm not going to discuss that anymore in any detail. Just mention that the result is actually a boring phase without any the whole U1 gauge series gone. However, we can do something less damaging. Basically, we can just gauge a global subgroup generated by this particular combination of the E field. So let me just show it in picture. So remember there's this electric one-form symmetry in the problem. So through every surface in the system, the electric flux is conserved. But now we can just take, say, on the torus or with PRI boundary condition, we take all the planes, say the XZ planes in this picture, just sum over all the planes. The electric flux is running through these planes, and that basically sums over all the electric fields, say, in the along the Y bounds. And that's, again, a symmetry of the problem, because we have a much larger symmetry to begin with if we don't add these gauge symmetry breaking terms. But now we can just gauge this particular symmetry that we sum over all the bounds along the Y direction, for example. Okay. And it's easier to see what this means in the continuum. So in continuum, this just means that we integrate over, say, this one component of the E field. But using Gauss law, that just simply becomes the dipole moment of the charge density. Okay, so with a minus sign coming from integrate by part. Therefore, this particular symmetry that I showed on previous slide is nothing but the conservation of electric dipole moment. And the reason that we do this is because In the definition of electric dipole moment, there's this factor of x that is somewhat unusual from the point of view of a global symmetry. Usually global symmetry is just, you know, the product of some, you know, the same kind of unitary over all sites. But here there's this unconventional position dependence. But now in the gauge theory, once the global U1 is already gauged, this term can be written as a more familiar kind of integral of some density, but now the density is the electric field of the U1 gauge theory. But then this looks like an usual U1 gauge, U1 symmetry, which can be gauged following the procedures that have been discussed in this school. Okay. So now we can just follow the nodes, no, just applying the standard procedure to gauge this gauge particular symmetry, whose density are the electric fields of my U1 gauge theory. And I'll discuss how this actually is done. So I'll do it in two dimensions, because it's just hard to draw things in three dimensions. But the generalizations is fairly straightforward. So suppose we want to gauge a symmetry that corresponds to the E fields along the X bonds. So the blue dots denote the bonds where the E fields live that we want to gauge. The symmetry is a sum over all these E fields. And you can see that they live on a kind of shifted square lattice. Okay, no, I draw these dotted lines just to guide your eye. And we can put gauge fields on the bounds of these shifted square lattice corresponding to these E fields. Okay, I just put bounds everywhere, new gauge fields denoted by these red diamonds on these bounds of this shifted lattice, which are both the sides of the original lattice and also the placate center of the original lattice. Okay. So this is for the bound, the X bonds, the electric fields on the X bonds. And we can also do it for the Y bonds, which are basically, you know, just 90 degree rotated from the X bonds. So it's essentially the same kind of configuration. So to gauge these two symmetries in 2D, I mean, 3D would have to have three of them, but it's, otherwise it's very similar. So in 2D, we have to put two gauge fields on each side, two new gauge fields, which I denote by a tilde on each side, and two new gauge fields on each placate, because we have two U1 symmetries for the X and Y electric fields. Okay, that's the two components of dipole moment in 2D. And the rest is fairly standard, has been discussed thoroughly in these lectures. So I won't go through all the details of this gauging, but I just want to highlight one term in this gauged Hamiltonian that is, remember now that the E fields of the original theory are the charge densities. Okay? Therefore, the cosine, the lattice B square term, is no longer invariant under this new gauge transformations. So we have to minimally couple this cosine curve of A term to the new gauge fields. And just staring at these figures, you can convince yourself that all you need to do is to put this on, add these two terms to the cosine. Basically, this is the X component and Y component of the new field with a relative minus sign between them. Okay. And this is the minimal coupling one needs to do to gauge these two symmetries. Okay. And what this does is essentially kind of Higgsing the difference between the X and Y components of the placate gauge new gauge fields A tilde, and essentially the sets, tilde X and tilde A tilde X and A tilde Y to be exactly the same. So I'll just denote it by A tilde XY. So now after with Higgsing and in limit of large K, and the low energy theory, we really just have one gauge field on each placate, which I call A tilde XY. And then we also have these side gauge fields, A tilde XX and A tilde YY. Okay. So together at low energy, once K is large, we have now three gauge fields, A tilde XX, A tilde YY, and A tilde XY, and they're naturally associated with sides for the two kind of diagonal components and placate for off-diagonal components. And this is what we expect. We expect that we should get a symmetric tensor gate theory because that's how that gives you the dipole conservation. And we see that it kind of very naturally arises from this construction. Okay, so we have symmetric tensor gauge field, and you can work through all the other terms, the Gauss law, the magnetic field, and they all come out expected for the symmetric tensor gauge theory. Okay, so this is the first kind of way to build a fractonic gauge theory from an ordinary gauge theory, just by gauging a particular U1 symmetry, a particular 3 U1 gauge symmetry, therefore I think 3D, of an ordinary U1 gauge theory. Okay. And these symmetries are nothing but the conservation of dipole moment of the gauge charges, but once you write it in terms of gauge field, of the electric fields, they take the very familiar form and can be gauged just by following the standard procedure of gauging a global symmetry. Okay. So this is the first way that we can obtain a fractonic U1 gauge theory from an ordinary U1 gauge theory. So this concludes the kind of the first part of my talk. And next I'll discuss a different kind of perspective on some of these fractonic U1 gauge theories. But to do that, first let me kind of zoom out and think a little more abstractly about what fractons, how to really define fractons, how to really define mobility of a quasi particle. Of course, usually we would add all the generic terms in Hamiltonian and see what kind of dispersion you get for these quasi particle excitations. But it would be nice to have a way to do it without resorting to a particular kind of Hamiltonian and working out the details of the dispersion relation, etc. Okay. So to do this, it's actually useful to have a translation symmetry in the problem. I mean, in all these models, we do have translation symmetry, although these phases are robust with respect to weak breaking of translation symmetry, but it's conceptually very useful to have translation symmetry in place, let the translation in place in order to discuss the mobility of quasi-particle excitations. So suppose we consider, say, this a region of a system which contains a quasi-particle, like here. And to see whether you can move it to, say, a nearby location, well, first we can actually create a state where the quasi-particles is translated to, say, the next available location on lattice, next site, whatever. And this is not moving the quasi-particle to a next state. This is just the state that one would get if the quasi-particle was moved to say the next site. And we can do this just by applying a translation operator to this quasi-particle. Okay. However, if these two states belong to different superselection sectors, then it means that no physical operators can connect these two states. So no physical local operators can have non-zero matrix elements between these two states that I just showed. And also such a physical process does not exist. It means that no matter what you do, there's no way to move a quasi-particle from say this position to the next position. And this quasi-particle is therefore immobile along this direction. Therefore, translation symmetry kind of provides a convenient way to formulate the notion of mobility of quasi-particles. We just need to ask whether the quasi-particle and a state where it's translated along some direction belong to the same superselection sectors or not. And this idea was really systematically formulated by Pai and Hermley in recent work. Okay.
Mong, I just want to let you know you have 10 minutes left.
Yes. Thank you. So now let's apply this observation to the case of the charge and dipole moment. Okay. So we have, let me write down the definition of charge and dipole moment in continuum. So we have the total charge, which is the integration of the charge density and dipole moment, the usual expressions. Now, if we apply a translation, what we get is the total charge is the same since it's just integrated over the whole space. But the dipole moment, after we translate, say, by a lattice via distance A, picks up additional contribution Q times A. So we can really view this line as a kind of definition of a dipole moment that is under translation. It picks up this additional contribution proportional to the distance and also the charge, total charge of the system. Okay. On the lattice, once we kind of choose the right units for this dipole moment, we can write them in a kind of matrix equation. So for example, Q in 2D, we have really three U1 charges. So at this point, we kind of forget about where this dipole moment came from. We just have in mind three independent U1 charges, but they are related to each other under translation in this particular way. Right? When we translate, the Q remain the same, but the dipole moments, the two dipole moments are mixed with the global charge Q according to these matrices. Okay. So we can just kind of take this as the definition of the charge and dipole moment. Which are three independent U1 charges, but transform in a particular way under the translation symmetry. Okay. And we can generalize this observation. So we can kind of just abstractly think about a general U1 times U1 times U1. Say you have n U1 gauge symmetries. And for now, forget about all the details about, say, the Hamiltonian and details of the interactions. Just focus on the kinematics, meaning that we just focus on n U1 gauge symmetries. So you have totally n U1 charges. And these U1 charges, you can redefine them. You can just make some linear combinations of them. And as long as preserving the integrity of these U1 charges and all any transformations allowed, because we're not thinking about the dynamics, we're just thinking about the kinematic structure of theory. Therefore, they can be transformed. You can do a change of variable where the W is any invertible integer matrices. They're just giving a new basis for these U1 charges. And you can regard this as the symmetries of the kinematic structure. It's not the actual symmetry, not necessarily the actual symmetry of Hamiltonian, but just the symmetry of the gauge symmetry of the kinematic structure of the theory. And we are not thinking about the magnetic sector right now, just the electric sector. Therefore, the lattice translation can take, say, these n U1 charges to a transformed basis, applying some matrices to this U1, to these n U1 charges. And these matrices encode the mobility of the electric charges of this U1 gauge theory. Therefore, we can think about inserting a defect of such a symmetry, of such a kind of a symmetry of the U1 gauge theory, where we take, when the defect, what defect means here is that if you take a charge across this wall, I mean, this is 2D, but in 3D, it's just really a plane. Once you take a charge across this plane, this charge is acted by this particular transformation, so it becomes a different kind of charge, W times Q. Okay, this is what this wall does. Now you can imagine I put in lots of these walls inside a U1, apparent U1 gauge theory. And what happens is that the charge keeps being transformed into different types of charges. And if this W has infinite order, meaning that any power of W is different from 1, and then these charges are generally immobile because it's transformed into a different kind of gauge charge. So there's no ways to locally connect these two different charges because it belongs to different super selection sectors. So a general charge becomes immobile unless there's certain k under which W of Q, W to the k's power times Q is Q, but otherwise this charge is immobile. And you can do it in all directions by putting another network of these, another stack of these defect walls in a different direction. So this is another way to kind of think about this fractonic U1 gauge theory, basically having some defect walls that forbids the charges from moving. So once a charge passes through the defect wall, it becomes a different type belonging to a different superselection sector, so you cannot connect them locally. Okay. And you can actually realize this idea concretely on lattice. So since I'm running out of time, I'm not going to discuss this in the detail. So the lattice, but we can write down a lattice realization for any W matrices. Fairly easily, you just modify the lattice derivative by these W matrices. And if you take these W matrices corresponding to the charge, total charge and dipole moment, and you know, write down the lattice model as I described on the previous slide, and this gives exactly the same model as you know, the gauge D1 model that I talked about earlier. Okay. So I just mentioned that you know, this for many choice of W, the photons are gaps, so it's not automatically giving you gapless U1 gauge series, but we have lots of different choices to play with. Now, for the remaining couple minutes, I'll just briefly discuss a general construction where we also consider the magnetic sectors because U1 gauge theory has both electric and magnetic charges. So a general particle carries both electric and magnetic charges. Okay. But the magnetic and electric charges see each other as non-locally, they have statistical interactions between them. And again, the kinematic structure of a theory has a lot of symmetries. You can plot all the excitations, these charge excitations on the so-called charge lattice, where the two axes just label the integer values of these of the electric and magnetic charges. However, we can do some basis changes of the charge lattice. We can, instead of using the standard basis like this one, we can use, for example, a 90 degree rotated basis, like what I show here, and that's called S transformation of the lattice. Or we can do a kind of shearing of the lattice by using this basis, and that's called the T transformation. And together generate a group called SL2Z, and we can have a similar story for U1 to the nth power gauge theory. But just want to note that the T is an infinite order operation. Therefore, you can use it, you can exploit it to kind of build a network that makes excitations fractonic. And if you think about it for a moment, while the T wall is really just the integer quantum Hall state, because if you say pull a magnetic monopole across the quantum Hall, in this process, the flux of this quantum Hall layer changes by 2 pi. So this is basically just like adiabatically inserting minus 2 pi flux to this quantum Hall. Therefore, you have to nucleate some charges to the quantum Hall, and that charges have to be dressed on this magnetic monopole. And once you have a stack of these walls, you get fractonic behavior for these magnetic monopoles, because basically the monopole undergoes this T transformation across each of these walls, and the T transformation is of infinite order, so it never kind of comes back. I just want to mention that if you actually insert this stack of quantum Hall states into the U1 gauge theory, you actually modify the spectrum of the photons. Okay, so I don't have time to go through the rest two slides. I'll just summarize that have these two ways to obtain a fractonic U1 gauge theory from either gauging global symmetry in ordinary U1 gauge theory or by inserting this network of defects into, again, a Maxwell U1 gauge theory. Okay, thanks for your attention.
Thanks, Meng, for the nice talk. So maybe we have time for one question. So I saw there was a question in the Q&A, although it already been answered by Mike Hermley, but maybe you would like to comment it a little bit more.
Sure.
So that is how to understand the dipole conservations if the theory is on a torus.
Sorry, so how to understand the
dipole conservation if the theory is on a torus?
Yes, so if the theory is on the torus, well, the dipole charge is no longer, this is a well-known subtlety in the definition of dipole moment or polarization with periodic boundary conditions, because the position X has this ambiguity of L of the size of system. So in that case, the dipole symmetry is broken down from U1 to a subgroup Z of roughly Z of L. Yes, so that is what happened. But that's a well-known subtlety in the definition of dipole moment or polarization with periodic boundary conditions. And it's, you know, for our purpose, it's useful to think about it just on R3, for example, without periodic boundary conditions.
Okay, yeah, thanks. So since we are running out of time, so maybe we should leave all other questions to the Q&A session. So let us thank Meng again for the nice talk, and also thank for APIC for handling the Q&A.